There is a temptation to share with you Dr. Gaffney's entire bio because it is impressive, but I do want to leave him time to speak this evening. But I fear that if no one who introduces him shares his entire bio, you'll never hear all of it. But you still won't hear all of it, but maybe in bits and pieces in the talks that you'll be hearing tonight and in the weeks to come, you'll get a chance to hear exactly some sense of his achievements and accomplishments. He is the Saul Rosenblum Professor of Jewish History at the Hebrew University, has been teaching at the Hebrew University for over 30 years. He made Aliyah to Israel as a youngster in 1958, having grown up first in Brooklyn and then in Israel, and made his commitment to Eretz Israel, to the land of Israel, and to the state of Israel as a youngster growing out of a Zionist family. He is, to put it as simply and succinctly as we can, one of the most impressive and accomplished Jewish scholars in the world today. We could point to the 100 or so articles that he wrote for the Encyclopedia Judaica, to the books that he's written, to the other articles that he's published, to the thousands and thousands of people around the world whom he has taught, to get some sense of his accomplishments. In addition to teaching at Hebrew University, he often is visiting other universities, including Harvard, Yale, Brown, Oxford, and now this week, Cal State Long Beach. And I was just so tempted to say a sentence that had Harvard, Yale, Brown, Oxford, and Cal State Long Beach in one sentence that I had to do that. He has written extensively in the area of Jewish life in the rabbinic period, especially the first and second century. But in addition to his quite impressive scholarship, if you may have already seen, if not, you will see this evening, that he is also a quite dynamic, energetic, and impressive teacher as well. And as we know, it doesn't help to have a tremendous amount of knowledge if you're not able to convey it. And Dr. Gaffney has a great ability to share his knowledge and his insights with people. And so it is a privilege and honor to welcome to our community through the CSP program, Dr. Isaiah Gaffney.
Give me a moment to get my papers organized here. As I do organize them, I want to tell you, first of all, although Rabbi Marison really suggested this, I want to repeat, I have to thank many people that made it possible for me to come, but Ari is really something unusual. It's a resource that I think you should all cherish. You could not have done any of this. You could not have done this without him. He could not have done this without you. So you obviously should be very, I think, proud collectively. But I can tell you that I am particularly happy to finally have arrived at Orange County, because it is only now that I can delete the scores of email messages that Ari has sent me during the last 2 years. My computer has been groaning, literally. And if I were to show you just a list of these messages, you would realize how much work he put into this. It's really almost something that cannot be believed. And I think now, this month, hopefully we'll all bear the fruits of his work. But it was really a tremendous effort, and I think that everybody should be aware of it. I'd like to open this discussion with a story that I was present at in Jerusalem, and as I mentioned to another group the other day, it's a story that really happened because I was there, and it's really quite rare for a historian to describe something that he knows actually happened. In other words, I can't resist this, because most of what I teach, I have no idea if there's any connection to the truth in it. About 25 years ago, no, more actually, over 30 years ago, a major debate, and more than that, almost a battle erupted in Jerusalem, one that only in Israel has the potential for bringing down government. Fortunately, it did not happen. It took place because of what in other countries would be a very simple affair. A monument was to be erected at the entrance of the city of Jerusalem. In fact, those of you who have been to Jerusalem may remember, as you enter the city, the main bus station is on one side, and the Jerusalem Convention Hall, known as Binyanei HaUmah, is on the other side. And between the two, they were going to erect this monument, which would memorialize the defenders of the city of Jerusalem between the years 1921 and 1948. In other words, during the years of the British Mandate and up until the founding of the State of Israel. And the monument would have one word written on the top. And this is where things got interesting. The debate was, what should that word be? Should we write Yizkor, he shall remember, meaning God, or shall we write Nizkor, we shall remember? And you might guess how the whole population, not only of Jerusalem, but of the state of Israel, automatically divided into two camps, the pro-Yizkor camp and the pro-Nizkor camp. And I was amazed. In fact, I was actually quite frightened, because I knew that in history, in the history of the ancient world, and I am a student of the ancient world, these debates often led almost to bloodshed, not among Jews alone. In fact, there was a similar debate in the early Christian world in the 4th and 5th centuries, precisely around one letter as well. There was a debate among the theologians of early Christianity, was the nature of Christ part of God, or was Christ similar to God? And the two words in Greek are homoousios or homoiousios. In other words, what was the one letter, a iota, a yud? The same exact letter over which the Jews now were debating. Should it be Yizkor or Nizkor? But in the Christian world, tens of thousands of people paid for that one letter with their life. Now, fortunately, it didn't come to this in Jerusalem, but it almost came to this. And there were placards plastered all over the city of Jerusalem. We demand that it be Yizkor, he shall remember, and not we shall remember. And I asked myself at the time, why? Why was it that a whole segment of the Israeli population, which you can almost guess, the more traditionally oriented segment, opted only for Yizkor? Was it because they simply had an affinity to the hallowed name of the prayer that I'm sure many of you, maybe all of you, are familiar with, the prayer in remembrance of parents, of ancestors? The word Yizkor, right, resonates in many people's minds. Or possibly, was it because certain people felt that if we remove God from the equation and we say we shall remember, we are in fact reflecting a certain wish to remove God from the cognizance, from awareness of what's happening in our world. In other words, it's not his business to remember. We are the ones that are involved. In other words, it was deemed by some people to almost be heresy of sorts. This denial of God's involvement. And so, this raised another question in my mind at the time. Why is it that Jews leave the remembering to God? Did they not develop a sense of a need, of a sacred requirement to know the past? He shall remember. Now, I'm sure many of you know that Professor Yerushalmi of Columbia University, Chaim Yosef Yerushalmi, wrote a book a number of years ago, which I highly recommend. The name of the book is Zachor. He wrote it in English. It's been translated into many languages. Yerushalmi claims that Jews ceased at a very early stage to be involved in historical contemplation and in doing post-biblical history, as it were, and historiography, because they believed that the Bible really encapsulated all of the processes of historical development. In other words, things constantly recur again and again, but that if you know the system of the Bible, you really know not only what happened in the past, but you know how history works itself out generation after generation. And so for Jews, there was no real need to do history. And indeed, after the writings of Josephus Flavius, the famous noted Jewish historian of the first century, who wrote about the Jewish war against the Romans, and who also wrote a major history of the Jewish people, after his work in the first century, the fact is that not one Jew would write a history book for the next 1,000 years. It is almost unimaginable. And even after that 1,000 years, the histories that would be written were not histories of the Jewish people, but they were histories of rabbinic literature, of the rabbinic movement. In other words, they were far more focused. This is unthinkable. This is unimaginable. Because Jews lived within the Greco-Roman world. And for Greeks and Romans, historiography was a calling. Historiography was one of the highest literary arts. And they cultivated historiographical production and thought. So how could Jews remove themselves in totality from thinking about history and from writing about history? Other scholars claimed that the Torah itself, because of its sense of being timeless, really precludes the need for thinking along historical patterns. The Torah is above time, they said. What was given at Sinai, we were told by the rabbis, was not just a particular book, but all of subsequent tradition. Whatever a disciple, the rabbis claim in the Talmud, whatever a disciple is destined to proclaim hundreds of years later was actually given to Moses at Sinai. When you believe that, then you are already ahistorical. You are cultivating a non-historical approach to life. Some people claimed that the rabbis themselves actually prevented historical thought from among Jews, because to the extent that you were aware of a developmental process where Jewish tradition is constantly being changed in light of new realities, well, then the power of the rabbis is diluted. It's not the rabbis that are developing tradition, it's life that's developing tradition. And so there was a claim among certain circles that the rabbis frowned on historical thought, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. Yet another possibility, and a very famous theory, why Jews did not do history was because at the end of the first century, Jews were removed from the political scene. They lost their independence, they lost their state, they lost their temple. The Romans destroyed Jerusalem, the Romans destroyed the temple. And a nation without any involvement in the ongoing political processes does not think along political lines, and as a result does not think along historical lines. In other words, the equation of history equals political involvement, political interest. Now, I have to be quite frank with you. There might be another reason why Jews stopped doing history or were never really taken by history. And I think you'll be able to empathize with this. It could be that they thought it was boring. Now, I'm not inventing this. We have impeccable biblical proof how boring history can be. And I don't know how many of you know what I'm alluding to. You all have heard of the Megillah, the story of Esther. Esther, Haman, Mordechai, Purim. And in that book, there's a very little side story. In the sixth chapter, it says in Hebrew, I'll of course translate, "Balayla hahu nadeda shenat hamelech." That night, the king, Ahasuerus, could not sleep. He tried everything. Nothing would work. But then what did he ask to be read before him? The history books. Because he knew that where everything else failed, that might succeed. And I always, obviously as a history professor, one wonders whether the wisdom of the Bible somehow eludes us time and again. But for whatever reason, Jews did not cultivate this rabbinic sense, this historical sensitivity. And the reason is, or the question is, why? It could be that they believed that our existence and the developments of this world, at least as far as the Jewish people are concerned, follow a different set of rules. And that different set of rules is alien to the thought processes of a historian, of a Greco-Roman historian. When Thucydides, the great Greek historian, approached the writing of the Peloponnesian War, if you ever look at the very first chapter, he's convinced that it's the economic conditions, the geographical conditions, the military realities that would determine the results of this major conflict between Greeks and Persians. Compare that with the following statement that appears in the Babylonian Talmud. The Talmud asks an interesting question. There were two major empires existing in Talmudic times, the Roman Empire of the West and the Persian Empire of the East. And the Talmud asks, which of the two empires would ultimately be victorious? Which would defeat the other? Now, if Thucydides were to ask this, or Tacitus, or Polybius, what would they do? They would check the relative military powers, right? They would check the economics, the stability of the two empires. The rabbis know the truth. And so, Rabbi Judah ben Eli said as follows, Rome is destined to fall to Persia. How do I know this? Well, it has to happen. Because the first Jewish temple, built by the Israelites, was destroyed by the Babylonians. And we know that the Persians defeated the Babylonians, so that's one good deed for the Persians. The same Persians, Cyrus, also permitted the building of the second temple, so that's 2-0. And the second temple was destroyed by the Romans. That's 3-0. Have you any doubts that the Persians will defeat the Romans? What could be more obvious? What could be clearer? And this, for them, is the basis for historical development. The whole series of assumptions, the whole underlying basis for an ongoing development in this world is based on what? Who does good for the Jews? Who does bad for the Jews? It sounds familiar. Or give you another example of how historical causality is understood by the rabbis. You all remember the story of the spies that were sent in by Joshua was one of them, to spy the land of Canaan before the ultimate conquest. And the spies come back to the Israelites in the desert and they say, yes, it's a wonderful land, but it is beyond our capabilities as far as conquest is concerned. They're too powerful. We are midgets compared to them. And the Bible describes that when they in fact delivered that very pessimistic message, And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. Numbers 14, chapter 14, verse 1. All the congregation wept that night, to which the rabbis said, that night was the eve of the ninth of Av. Now, the ninth of Av, as you know, Tisha B'Av, would be the night that commemorates the destruction of the two future temples of Israel, the first temple and the second temple. So here we have Israelites in the desert before they even entered the land of Canaan, already crying, already mourning on the ninth of Av, before anything has even happened. God told them, you wept this time without reason. I therefore shall appoint for you weeping on this night for generations to come. So what determined the fall of the temple, or of both Jewish temples? And not only their fall, but their fall on a particular day in future history, the sins of the Israelites in the desert. What would a historian say about a statement like that? This is antithetical to historical processes. This is determinism. Whatever will happen in the next 1,000 years between the crying in the desert and the destruction of the second temple on the ninth of Av will change nothing. This was determined. Thucydides would have been aghast had he heard a statement like that. And so when you develop this type of a mindset, that the rules by which the history of Israel is governed, the rules are so radically different, this is not going to lead, possibly, to the production of history. In fact, the rabbis frequently seem to be putting down any historical contemplation. Whenever, I won't say whenever, but in many cases in the Talmud, somebody will ask a question about the past. And instead of answering the question, the Talmud will say, quite unelegantly, who cares? What happened, happened. In Aramaic, mai dehava hava. And this put down is very interesting, because sometimes they ask questions about the Bible itself. For instance, a very interesting example, and you'll see why it's an interesting example. The Talmud knows that Moses prepared Aaron to be the high priest in the tabernacle. Aaron and his sons would become the priests. And the Torah describes how Moses dressed them with the priestly vestments. And the Talmud asks, in what order did Moses dress them? Did he dress Aaron first and then his sons, or did he dress them together? To which the Talmud answers, who cares? That's history. That's the past. What are you? Suddenly you became a historian? Right. But the Talmud is not going to back down so easily. And the Talmud says, no, 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 you have to understand why I ask this question. It's not because of the past, it's because of the future. If the temple shall ever be rebuilt again, how will we dress the high priests? Will we dress Aaron first and then his sons, or all together? To which the Talmud says, pretty much tongue in cheek, don't lose too much sleep over this. When Aaron is brought back to life, he'll be accompanied by Moses, right? And you get a sense that the Talmud is playing with us, but the Talmud hasn't given up yet. The Talmud says, you think I'm asking a question because I have a historical interest? No, it's because there are two scriptures, one in Leviticus and the other in the book of Numbers. And in one of the scriptures, it says that Aaron came first and then his sons. And in the other scripture, it says they were all dressed together. Why do I like that discussion as a historian? Because it shows that the rabbis were keenly aware of the different reasons and justifications for doing history. The first question, how did he dress them in the past, is the classic question of an antiquarian historian. What happened in the past? And there are no pretensions. I want to know what happened. Or what was the reality in which things took place? I used a German phrase in one of my previous lectures this week, because it was exactly the phrase that was used by a German historian in the 19th century, Ranke, who was considered one of the great historicists. And his phrase was, wie es eigentlich gewesen ist. What was the historical context in which things happened? But the Talmud says, I don't care about history. But what is the next attempt? No, we want to know how things will be done in the future. That's why we ask. This falls under the category of the uses of history. Why do we do history? Not to know what happened, but so that we can apply them to the future. The Talmud says, I don't care about that either. When the problem arises, we'll find the solution. And then the Talmud seems to say, I'm only willing to discuss the issue if it's a problem of understanding scriptures. In other words, what is the Talmud saying here? To raise questions of history is to enter uncharted waters. We rabbis don't do history. And so if you're going to phrase the question in a historical context, we're going to put you down. Only if you can show that it has some meaning for understanding the text of the Bible, then we're willing to address the issue. And so it appears that the rabbis are frowning, as it were, on the issue of historical conception, of trying to understand events the way a historian would approach them. But having said all this, the rabbis, nevertheless, were keenly aware of the difference between past and present. And this is where we're going to approach the issue of rabbinization. What do I mean? I would almost pose this as a question to the audience. For the rabbis, which of those two periods was considered to be a grander period? One in which Jews or the people of Israel really reached the highest levels of their religious expression. Was it the past or was it the present? And I suspect that you will supply me with one answer, and that is the answer that I am going to take issue with. Is there anyone here brave enough to scream out, which do you think the rabbis consider to be the greater of the two, the past or the present? The past, thank you. This was not planned in advance, but I'm happy. We have this natural assumption that for Jews, the past was envisioned as this hagiographic, idealistic, wonderful past, right? Where our forefathers were angels, and we, in comparison to them, are at the most human beings, possibly even donkeys. In fact, that phrase actually appears in the Talmud. If our forerunners are angels, then we are human beings. If our forerunners are human beings, we are donkeys. And so on the one hand, you have this sense that the past was viewed in some sort of an ideological aura of perfection. However, when you get down to things, you'll find that this may not be the way rabbis actually envisioned the present vis-a-vis the past. And it could be very well just the opposite. But let me give you a few examples. They call themselves rabbis or sages, wise men, and they became the new leaders of the Jewish people. Who are the old leaders of the Jewish people? Who are the old spiritual guides of the Israelites? The prophets. And the rabbis say, in no uncertain terms, a sage takes precedence to a prophet. And this appears in different variations throughout rabbinic literature. Because a prophet can only say, literally, verbatim, what was divulged to him by God. Whereas a sage is permitted to think. To think, to address issues, to solve issues, to come up with new solutions. And they are not at all reticent about claiming that, in fact, we have reached a higher level, I would almost say, of intellectual achievement. But they go a step further. And by the way, there are all sorts of interesting parables. What might this be likened to? A king that sent two messengers to a foreign country. Regarding one of the messengers, he told the people, only if he shows you a sign or a signet from me shall you listen to him. Whereas the other fellow that I send you, whether he shows you a sign or a signet ring, listen to him no matter what. The first person is the prophet who has to show some sign that he is in fact an authentic prophet. The sage need not show any sign and listen to him no matter what. But this is only one aspect. The second one might be even more radical than the first. What was the means of worship? The worship of God in Jewish history up until the year 70 of the Common Era. Sacrifice. The temple. Priesthood. And this was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. And the rabbis would institute, instead of that biblical image of worship, sacrificial worship, a new system, which we usually refer to as rabbinic Judaism. It's a system that we all, and this transcends all of the groupings within the Jewish people today, we all adhere to this system. Prayer instead of sacrificial worship. Prayer anywhere, not necessarily in a temple, meaning a temple in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. A synagogue can be anywhere. In Israel, in the diaspora. You don't require priests anymore. In fact, you don't even require rabbis to pray. Laymen can get together and pray as long as they have a quorum. And the rabbis will say more than that. They will say that prayer supersedes sacrifice. And that prayer is more effective than sacrifice. And that one who prays need not offer up this sacrifice or that sacrifice or the other. Do you realize what we're talking about here? A spiritualized version of Judaism. In rabbinic eyes, a heightened version. Not just more sophisticated, more spiritual. More accessible to everyone. The rabbis were very, very willing to claim that their version, in many, many ways, was a higher level of Jewish existence. We have reached a higher level in our relationship with God. And just as rabbis take precedence to prophets, the system for worship now also takes precedence. But this, of course, raised a question. This sounds suspiciously like what another community was claiming. Because there was another community living at that very same time, the first centuries, that was also claiming that it reached a higher level of Israelite expression. And of course, I'm talking about early Christianity. The Christian church used a very important phrase, and this is a phrase that, of course, I'm using it in English now, supersession. We are new Israel, and the new Israel supersedes the old Israel. We are a spiritualized Israel. We are the true Israel, verus Israel in Latin. And so, in many ways, this is a very Christian mindset. And the rabbis had a problem here. Are we claiming supersession? Are we claiming that we are really better than our patriarchs? Because we have a heightened, a more spiritual way of expressing our religious beliefs? How do you solve the problem? And they came up, of course, with a unique solution. It is a heightened way of religious expression, but we want you to know it's always been with us. And this is when they institute what we call the rabbinization of the past. You think we rabbis invented prayer? We have news for you. It was the three patriarchs that invented prayer. Abraham, the morning prayer, Isaac, the afternoon prayer, and Jacob, the evening prayer. In fact, there is one Midrash that claims that King David came along and decided that for Yom Kippur, we should have a fourth prayer, Ne'ilah. And this is the beginning, the tip of an iceberg. And you realize how the rabbis are getting over a very uncomfortable situation here by claiming none of this is new. Yes, there were always prophets, but basically there were always rabbis because there were always yeshivas. And that's why after Isaac's Akedah, after Isaac was bound on the altar by Abraham, but he survived, and this, here the rabbis start playing games, and these are wonderful games. You remember Abraham goes to offer up his son Isaac as a sacrifice, but of course at the last moment he's saved. And instead they offer up a ram. And then the Bible ends off by saying, and Abraham returned to his servants. And the Midrash asked, the rabbis asked, where's Isaac? Why didn't he come home with his father? And my favorite answer is, well, after this happened, Abraham realized he's got to ship Isaac off to yeshiva for a few years. Very simple. And so Isaac went to the local yeshiva of Shem Va'ever, and they say this without batting an eyelash. All the subsequent fathers will go through a similar process. Rebecca, you remember, had twins. Rebecca, Isaac's wife, had twins, Jacob and Esau. And the Bible describes how these twins were causing her tremendous pain during labor and before labor, during her pregnancy. The children were running around in her womb. And the Midrash explains, well, why were they causing such pain? Because every time she passed by a synagogue, Jacob wanted to get out. And every time they passed by a pagan temple, Esau wanted to get out. Now, there's a problem. There were no synagogues yet. In fact, there would not be synagogues for another 1,000 years, right? And what is amazing is that the same rabbis, two lines later in the same place, claim, but of course we know there were no synagogues. So it must mean something else. But they had no problems claiming that the patriarchs not only studied Torah, they all kept Shabbat. For instance, Abraham actually kept the laws of not carrying on Shabbat. But not only did he keep the laws of not carrying on Shabbat, he did something that many Jewish communities now are grappling with. He set up an Erov, right, so that they could carry on Shabbat. Once the three patriarchs became rabbis, it was only a hop, skip, and a jump to go back a little in time and to turn Adam into one as well. And this is very interesting. Adam becomes, in rabbinic literature, the first Jew. Now, you think about him as the founder of the human race, but the rabbis will tell you no. Adam spoke Hebrew. Not only did he speak Hebrew, he actually wrote one of the Psalms, which interestingly is, of course, the psalm that praises Yom HaShabbat, the day of the Sabbath, because that was almost his birthday, if you remember, right? He studied Torah in the Garden of Eden. In fact, this is my favorite, he kept Passover in the Garden of Eden. And for years, I have tried to imagine Eve cleaning for Passover in the Garden of Eden. Now, what was she looking for? Right? But knowing good Jewish, you know, mothers and wives, I'm sure, right, that she was making Adam's life miserable as Passover approached. But of course, you realize Passover commemorates, right, the salvation of the Jews from Egypt, which is going to happen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years down in history. The rabbis do not bat an eyelash. And you see what they're doing. They are creating a totally different past. They are so enamored with their spiritualization of Jewish history that they're not willing to cheat, as it were, the fathers of the Jewish nation from this wonderful innovation. And so they simply impose it on, well, not impose, they grant it to their forefathers as well. This process was very interesting because they gained something else. In early Christianity, it was very important for the earliest Christians to stress that Adam and Abraham did not keep any mitzvot at all. Because Adam, as you know, or as you may know, was a precursor of Christ himself. In fact, Christ was actually crucified on top of Adam's grave. We're going to talk about this very briefly in a second. And in Christianity, at least from the days of Paul, there are no practical commandments. Everything had become spiritualized. The mistake of the ancient, not the mistake, but the, I should say, the setback of ancient Israel was what? When ancient Israel thought it had to keep practical laws like circumcision and not eating certain foods, etc., etc. And for early Christianity, that was actually a descent from the spiritualized existence of Adam in the Garden of Eden until the original sin. So Adam had no mitzvot at all to keep. He was all spirit, according to Christianity. And so you see what the rabbis are gaining. They actually will claim that Adam kept mitzvot in the Garden of Eden. He was one of us. He becomes so much one of us that something very interesting happens. Does anyone know where Adam is buried? Have you ever visited his burial spot? This is very interesting. I can prove that in the Second Temple period, Jews believed that Adam was buried in Jerusalem. Probably even they believed he was buried on the Temple Mount or under the Temple Mount. We have proof of this. Early Christianity would claim the same thing, but like many other traditions, it moved Temple Mount traditions to Golgotha, the place where Jesus was crucified. And Adam was buried right under the cross, so much so that if you visit Jerusalem and come to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you will be pointed to the crypt of Adam, where Adam is buried. But why is this so fascinating? Because when the rabbis slowly begin turning Adam into a Jew, they've got to remove him from that burial spot. And somewhere in the early 3rd century, his body was exhumed and transferred where? Well, once he becomes Jewish, there's only one place for him to be buried, in the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron. And so according to good rabbinic tradition, where is he buried today? In Hebron, together with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And rabbinic tradition has him there. This is fascinating. And as a result, pilgrims, this was early Christian pilgrims coming to Palestine in the 4th and 5th century who wanted to visit Adam's gravesite, the church father Jerome says, look, you better hedge your bets. If you want to be certain you saw his gravesite, go to Jerusalem, but also go to Hebron. But what is fascinating is this is when you begin to imagine history as a spiritual phenomenon, you can play, as it were, fast and loose with the past as well. When could the rabbis do this? When they were removed from the political vicissitudes of the real world. And apparently this is what happened. Jews, and this probably explains why Jews are not writing history, because in many ways, they removed themselves from history. Once the temple was destroyed, once the last war against the Romans was a total disaster, the Bar Kokhba uprising of the years 132 to 135, a tremendous change takes place in Jewish self-identity. And they begin to play down radically any quest for political independence. You have statements saying, stop talking about messianic salvation. It's not in your power. And cursed are the bones of those who try to figure out when the Messiah will come. Let us remove ourselves to a spiritualized level of existence that really has nothing to do, as I said, with the political realities of this world. People who accept that mindset are not going to write history. But of course, what is the danger in this? You remove yourself from history. You forego some of the most sacred desires and beliefs that are cultivated in Jewish tradition. Will you never reassume a central location in Jerusalem for worship? Will you never reconstitute a monarchy? Will you never have a state? And I'd like to show you how at least one rabbi could not accept this removal from history. And I'm dying to know who wrote this text. It is one of the most powerful rabbinic expositions on the subject of history and Jews that I know of. It is in a midrash, and it is a rabbinic description of Jacob's ladder. Now, I'm sure many of you remember Jacob is fleeing his brother Esau after stealing the blessings, and he's running away. And as he flees, he goes to sleep, and he sees a ladder. A ladder based on the ground, but reaching the heavens. And the angels, right, and it says in Genesis, he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the rabbis have a keen ear. If there's one thing I want to impart to all of us during these next few weeks is, when they read the Bible, they had a very keen ear to every discrepancy, everything that shouldn't be there and is there. And what did they notice? That the angels were doing what? Ascending and descending. And they said, that doesn't make sense. We all know where angels live. Angels live up there. So what should the scripture have said? The angels were descending and ascending. How can they come up before having come down? There must be a problem here. And the rabbinic interpretation goes as follows, and I'll read this for you. The first one is really the introduction, and then we get to the nitty-gritty. Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman said, "Do you really think these were angels? No, they were masters of the nations of the world," meaning they were the great empires of the world that were going up and down the ladder. "He," God, "showed him the master of Babylonia ascending 70 rungs, and the master of Persia ascending 72 rungs, and of Greece 180 rungs." In other words, every nation goes up the ladder, a number of rungs on the ladder that is equivalent to what? The rule of that empire in the east. And so he sees Babylonia and Persia, which he calls Media, and Greece. And then he saw Edom. Now, Edom is Rome, Edom. But you have to remember that for the rabbis, Edom, Rome, is also Christianity. He saw Rome ascending and ascending and not knowing how many rungs. But of course, why could Jacob not know how many rungs Rome is ascending the ladder? Because the author of our text is living under Roman rule. So he has no fixed number. He, Jacob, asked God, "Master of the universe, tell me, will he, Rome, descend?" And God answered, "Jacob, even if you see him reaching the heavens, I will lower him, as it is written," and now he quotes one of the prophets, "if you, Rome, ascend," or Edom, "ascend like an eagle and place your nest among the stars, from there I will lower you," said God. I like this. This is the Roman eagle. But now comes the second part of this exposition, and this is the powerful one. Rabbi Berechia said in the name of Rabbi Meir, "He showed him the master of Babylonia ascending and descending, of Media going up and coming down, of Greece going up and coming down, and Rome ascending and descending." In other words, what does Jacob see? What is Jacob being shown if he sees, what, excuse me? The rise and fall of empires. He's being given a lesson in what you and I would call history. And he sees what? That this is the way of the world. What goes up comes down. And he asks God. He said, Master of the universe, just as these have descended, I too will descend? What is his problem? And we'll see this in a minute. Should I get on the ladder? Because if I get on the ladder, what have you just shown me? That what goes up comes down. What is his question? What is Jacob asking? Should I be part of the historical process of this world? Should I throw my lot in with the world? Am I part of this? Because I fear that if I'm part, I'm no different from anyone else. God answered. God told him, fear not. Go up, for you will ascend but not descend. You'll be different. Now, this is very interesting. What is God telling him? This is antithetical to, I don't know, Satmar Hasidim or to ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionist approaches to life, saying what? We should not be involved in politics and have a state and have an army and have everything that's involved. Why? We're different. What is this Midrash saying? Just the opposite. Get on the ladder. Go up, but I'll be on your side. You can almost call this religious Zionism. Because that's what Zionism is all about. Being like all the other nations. And a religious Zionist will say, yes, but we pray for God's help. But we need all of the trappings of an actual historical political entity. But now listen to what the rabbi here says. He told Jacob, go up, you will ascend and not descend. Nevertheless, Jacob was afraid and did not ascend. You realize what our rabbi is saying here? He's pointing an accusing finger. But who is Jacob? Jacob is a symbol. You know, Jacob had another name. What was his other name? Israel. This text is pointing an accusing finger at Israel. You removed yourself from history, thinking maybe you could exist in a spiritual existence or a spiritual reality removed from the processes of the world. It doesn't work that way. And now comes the terrible accusation. Jacob, had you believed and gone up, you would never have descended. And you realize why think about this. What was the situation? Jacob is running away from his brother Esau. What does that mean? Think about the symbolism of this midrash. He cannot confront reality. His brother poses a threat. What do? If you're part of the historical world, you confront the threat. But if you remove yourself from the historical world, what do? You run away. Where is the dream taking place? You know what the great commentator Rashi says about the angels? Who are the angels going up and down the ladder? The angels of the land of Israel were going up, and the angels that serve people outside of the land were coming down, because angels living in the land of Israel do not get visas to go abroad, and vice versa. So where is he dreaming? He's dreaming not only while he's running away from history, he's running away from his land as well. You bet he's dreaming. This is a dream of conscience. Am I doing the right thing? And God says, you did the wrong thing. You chose wrong. And because you chose wrong, this midrash ends and says, right, you will be caught up and involved with the nations. You will be tossed from nation to nation, from Babylonia to Persia, from Persia to Greece, from Greece to Rome. This is an indictment against that approach that was embraced. We're not part of history. And the indictment says, this was your mistake. And so, as I say, I'm dying to know who wrote this. It's attributed to a rabbi, but these attributions can never really be taken at face value. But clearly, what do we sense? that within the rabbinic world, there was a debate. Are we part of history or are we removed from history? And this fellow seems to be taking the other track. I would end off on one line here, and then I would be happy to take questions. 1900 years or 1800 years passed since this Midrash was written. And we finally got on the ladder in this generation or in the last few generations. We finally learned the lesson that we can't be removed from history. We have to be part of history. And I want to believe that just as we finally got the message and got on the ladder, that God would also fulfill this original promise to Jacob, meaning Israel, and tell us, now that you got on, I'll be on your side, and you'll never have to descend like all the others. I can only hope that, in fact, we finally learned our lesson. Thank you.